Welcome back. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Laborers Talk Radio. Thank you very much for tuning in. We enjoy your company. We appreciate all the great stuff that you're doing for the community, that's for sure. And I got to tell you, folks, very proudly that this program is sponsored in part by IBEW Local 5 and the Operating Engineers Local 66, both out of the Pittsburgh area, and we appreciate their support. But right now, this is Just Transitions. Dr. Patty DeMarco is in the house. Dr. Patty, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me, Charles. It's a wonderful spring day, and I have a wonderful person with me as my guest. We have the pleasure of having Grant Irvin, who is the director of the Chief Resilience Officer for the City of Pittsburgh under Mayor Peduto. He's in charge of resilience and responsiveness to sustainability initiatives in the planning department. And he's been overseeing that effort for quite a while now, to great effect. And he's going to talk to us today a little bit about the new resilience plan that has been just completed and the 100 Resilient Cities Initiative under the Rockefeller Foundation. Grant, welcome to our show.
Good afternoon. Thanks, Patty, and thanks, Charles, for having me here today.
It's our pleasure. Yeah. We appreciate it. Grant, you were just on a trip talking to some other people about resiliency for cities, getting some new ideas, that kind of stuff. What's going on?
Yeah, it's great. So thanks again. We were selected as the City of Pittsburgh as part of a partnership with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to do an exchange with one of our partner cities that are a part of the 100 Resilient Cities Initiative. And just, I guess, a first thing about the 100 Resilient Cities Initiative to tell your listeners a little bit about the program. The Rockefeller Foundation had created this initiative about 3.5 years ago to bring cities together around the challenges of urban resilience, really how cities can address to the shocks and stresses that we deal with, whether it's economic or weather or anything that cities are facing in and around the world, how do we organize around that? And as part of that program, we've pulled together a network of 100 cities globally across all the continents except Australia, or excuse me, Antarctica, that are now working in this practice of urban resilience. And one of the things that we were able to do was to strike a partnership with the city of Glasgow, Scotland, as part of an industrial cities network within the network.
And they were also a steel manufacturing center, correct?
Yeah, they were. They were the second city of the British Empire.
Mm-hmm. And Carnegie got a lot of his ideas there, too.
A lot of his ideas. Yeah. They were kind of at the leading edge of the Industrial Revolution, really responsible for shipbuilding and locomotive manufacturing. And the partnership that we built with them has extended into this networking opportunity through the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation around the idea of building a culture of health. And what we found was there was a lot of similarities, not just in terms of the economic collapse that both cities felt, but also in terms of health outcomes. Mm-hmm. And we are in the midst of kind of a three-date exchange where we've been now to Glasgow. They're coming here in the fall. And then we have a trip that we're going to flip a coin over in terms of who goes next. But what was really fascinating was that we learned that we had this common history, and the results of kind of the loss of population and economic decline really wore on both of our cities. But at the end of the day, we had a whole week of conversation around health outcomes. But at the end of the day, we had this conversation about the future of work and the impacts that work has, both in terms of technology advancements, but also how do we set up the right systems and structures to deal with kind of the ever-changing economy.
And that's a really important thing because, you know, the Industrial Revolution is a little while back now, and the world has been advancing, and some of these industries haven't really advanced much. And we're at a point now where the transition forward is actually in process. Mm-hmm. And there are, you know, things that are going to have to shift off of dead center if we're going to go forward. And you mentioned the workplace things. What kinds of things are you looking at as part of the Resilience Initiative in Pittsburgh around workplace challenges?
One of the big things that we've started to identify, and our strategy is called 1PGH. And listeners can go and learn more of the strategy by going to 1PGH.pittsburghpa.gov. And the strategy focuses on a core value set, which we call P4 here in Pittsburgh, which is people, place, planet, and performance. Those are the values that Pittsburgh residents have identified and kind of hold dear with regards to how do we develop policy and investment decisions. But the strategy is really organized around kind of four action steps. How do we initiate, amplify, accelerate, and coordinate. And it's within those structures that both individuals or neighborhoods or civic institutions can lead and help us in this transition. One of the key aspects that we focus on within the strategy is the idea around workforce development. And primarily one of the things that we've looked at in Pittsburgh, this is kind of falls under the amplify category, like things that we're doing really well in Pittsburgh and lessons we want to share nationally and globally. One of the best examples that we show out there is the Manchester Bidwell Corporation, which is a nonprofit that's been operating here in Pittsburgh just about a mile and a half from where we're sitting right now, where they're taking what I would call a non-traditional model of working with employers and identifying what their future needs are and then building the workforce capacity around that.
That sounds strikingly like what the building trades do with their signatory contractors, what Rosemary Trump was doing for years with SEIU 668, coordinate with the employers, anticipate the next skill sets that are needed and start training for those now so they're in place.
That's exactly right.
And the Manchester Bidwell also doesn't take traditional students only. They take people who may have been out of school for a while or, you know, never went all the way through and, you know, come back in through that medium to a new future. And they do one wonderful program there.
Right.
And that's a good point. I mean, one of the things that we've identified just a little bit about kind of the work in developing the strategy, we did a really deep and engaging civic engagement process.
Yeah.
Using town halls and deliberative forums and
it's like
individuals.
1,700 people involved at one point.
Just people I see on the street now, and they're like, you're that guy. Yeah. I recognize you from somewhere.
Yeah.
And one of the things that going into the conversation about developing the strategy was that we were very focused on the issues of infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So kind of the physical form of the city, if you will. And while that is definitely one of the main challenges that we face in terms of aging infrastructure and how do we modernize kind of the city that we face in and those opportunities, but at the core of it, we really recognize the strategy is about people and how do you provide opportunities for all of our residents to take place or take part in kind of the next economy.
Yeah, and the interconnectivity among neighborhoods, you know, making sure you have corridors of connection between where people are and where jobs are, and looking again at some of the strengths that Pittsburgh has had of being a really livable city where people can live, work, and play all in the same area, and returning to that core again, as it was when I grew up. You know, everybody lived pretty much in the city and the suburbs weren't all quite there yet. And the transit issues have come up as part of your resilience planning as well.
Yeah, mobility in general, I think, is a big piece in terms of both creating connectivity to where the jobs are and where the people are, and making sure that we're finding both affordable ways to facilitate that, but also making sure that people have high-quality experiences in that mobility decision. So we've made a lot of strategic investments in simple things like walking and biking infrastructure, but also major transitional opportunities like our bus rapid transit program, which first started out as a bus project, like how do we connect the two largest job centers in Pittsburgh, but really became a conversation about not how you get people through a community, but how do you get people to a community. Mm-hmm. And that project's called the Uptown Eco Innovation District. And this is really, you know, how do you, like you're saying, Patty, how do you create a strong physical form that people want to live in?
Right.
And the residents have really given us a lot of great ideas.
So we can come back to that and talk about what makes a community a livable place when we finish with our break.
Sure.
Absolutely. Thanks. And I'm hoping you guys introduce me to Marley, because I hear she's really cool.
I have my protege here with me today, and she has some words of wisdom to share with us,
there
I'm sure.
There we go. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Laborist Talk Radio.
A new in-depth look at access to programs for youngsters as part of Minnesota's new early childhood longitudinal data system finds that children of color, Native Americans, and lower-income children are more likely than their wealthier white peers to be enrolled in at least one of four early childhood programs in the state. Stephanie Hoganson, Research and Policy Director at the Children's Defense Fund Minnesota, says the Child Care Assistance Program drives access to early childhood programs, but nearly 90% of the kids who are income eligible aren't participating because of a lack of state funding.
Our legislature is currently debating some proposals to increase funding to the program as well as improve the program to make it more family-friendly and more accessible for families as well as easier to use for providers.
Governor Mark Dayton has said he wants to use part of the state's $1.65 billion budget surplus to fund preschool programs in the state, but Republicans released their own plan to eliminate it, close an art school, and remove multiple automatic budget increases for school programs. Dayton has called it appalling for lawmakers to use four-year-olds as bargaining chips in budget negotiations. Hoganson says focus and outreach needs to be placed on getting children of color, Native Americans, and those from lower-income families into early education programs. Nationally, 3- and 4-year-old Asian children are enrolled in school, including public and private early education programs, at a higher rate than their peers. However, of all the states, Minnesota has the lowest rate.
And Minnesota is a large immigrant population, and we have to pay attention to specific needs of immigrants to make sure outreach is targeted and transportation and language and literacy and other barriers are addressed.
Hoganson stresses the need for increased access to early childhood programs, saying it's one of the most effective ways to improve student achievement, close gaps between racial and socioeconomic groups, and create positive education results. For Minnesota News Connection, I'm Veronica Carter.
Hey, this is Charles Showalter, host of the Union Edge Laborers Talk Radio. I want to talk to you about an organization I'm proud to be part of, the Union Veterans Council. My friend, Will Fisher, runs the program. Will, he's a Marine and a member of the Painters Union. Will and the Veterans Council bring folks together and advocate for issues that are most important for veterans, especially the need for good jobs and a strong, fully funded, fully staffed Veterans Administration. Additionally, the Union Veterans Council works to remind folks that attacks on workers are attacks on veterans. Veterans and workers are one and the same. When vets like myself get out of the service, they're looking for a good family-supporting job. That's a union job, and the Union Veterans Council is the tip of the spear in the lead for these fights. In short, the Union Veterans Council stands for a better life and fights for those who have fought for us. You can learn more about the Union Veterans Council at www.unionveterans.org. That's unionveterans.org.
I'm Edward James Olmos, and I'm here with my local letter carriers to remind you that Saturday, May 13th is the annual Stamp Out Hunger Food Drive. You can help in the fight against hunger, and it's easy. Just leave a bag of non-perishable food by your mailbox on Saturday, May 13th, and your letter carrier will do the rest. All food collected goes directly to food banks and pantries in your local community. So on Saturday, May 13th, please join me and the National Association of Letter Carriers and Stamp Out Hunger.
Hello, welcome back. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Laborers Talk Radio. Thank you very much for tuning in. We enjoy your company. We appreciate all the great stuff that you're doing for the community. That's for sure. Hey, this program is sponsored in part by the American Federation of Government Employees, Local 2028, and the PFT 400, and we appreciate their support. In studio today for Just Transitions, we've got Patty DeMarco. Patty, welcome back.
Thank you, Charles. And I know that we're talking about sustainability and resilience. And one of the main reasons we worry about that is because of the kids and the next generation. And Grant has been so gracious as to bring his daughter with him for Bring Your Kids to Work Day. So would you introduce your daughter and ask her to say a word or two for us?
Yes, certainly. Thank you. So I have with me my daughter, Marley. She's age 9, and she is in third grade at Dilworth Elementary, which is part of the Pittsburgh Public School System. And she's one of our great joys in our life for my wife Amy and I, in addition to her younger sister Isla, who she just frowned at, for those who are listening. But Marley, maybe share a little bit about, kind of your thoughts on sustainability in the environment.
Well, I think we should teach our kids about the environment and sustainability, because if they learn this now, then when they grow up, they'll be better adults and be better at making better decisions and choices.
Well, there you go.
Thank you so
much. Marley, I would have thought you were like in high school. You driving a car yet?
I wish.
Okay, when you turn 16, tell mommy and daddy you want a Corvette. I'm just saying, hold out for a Corvette. They're pretty cool cars.
I'm looking more for a Toyota or something.
Toyota Prius.
Oh, get a Corvette. I'll let you drive my Volt.
Oh, there you go.
So there you go. So, and Marley, thank you for being with us today. We really are having fun having you here. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So, Patty, we're talking about resilience, and
yes.
There's a number of different Pittsburghers are tough.
Yep.
And we have gone through some very difficult times. I mean, you know, back in the early 80s when the mills were shutting down and there was no work and it was 14% unemployment.
We bounced back and we
turned
bounced
it
back, you know.
Yeah.
It's one of the things about Pittsburgh, and I think that's why we're one of the models around the whole country, around
right.
the world even, about how we're dealing with these challenges from climate change and needing to adapt to a different kind of a economy based on a different fuel base, and doing adaptations and changes that are really looking forward rather than backward. And Grant, you've really been the guru leading this effort in Pittsburgh, but there's a large group of planning collaborators that work on this, on all kinds of issues. You talked about people, planet, place, and performance, and those are a little bit beyond your triple bottom line type of understanding. And how did you get this whole process to come together and coalesce and be so effective in a relatively short time?
Yeah, I think there's kind of two real critical things that jump to mind at the forefront. One is great leadership.
Yes.
And, you know, Mayor Peduto, who is my boss, you know, really kind of set the tone in terms of a couple things. One, in terms of setting the vision and saying that, you know, this is the direction that we want Pittsburgh to go, and we know that we can do it. You know, he likes to call it the Pittsburgh way.
Yeah.
And effectively, the Pittsburgh way is really about the ability to work together as neighbors and how we can collaborate and address whatever challenges come our way, because they are going to come.
Yeah.
And to think that challenges aren't going to come our way is kind of an ignorant process. But the second thing that I think was really part of the key part of the mayor's vision was to engage the community. And it started really in his transition team, where we didn't have a 30-person transition team or 100 people, even. We had 1,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
And it was 1,000 residents that the mayor had asked to be a partner in developing what that vision is. Now, as an organizer around that, we were all freaked out because we had to manage 1,000 people. But residents gave us a lot of great ideas, including being participants in global processes like the Rockefeller Initiative.
Yes. So we've had a comprehensive kind of approach to this, with a lot of the ideas bubbling up from within communities, and have done some pretty off-the-wall things like the Eco District and the Almano Project, and really putting some goals out there that help people visualize a different way forward.
What are some of the projects that have been suggested that were maybe just a little bit novel that turned out to work really well?
Yeah, I think one of the things I'd highlight, and I was just telling this story earlier this morning in a meeting, has been the issue of district energy. So district energy for folks is the idea of how do you deliver energy at a district scale or a neighborhood scale. And going back to kind of the P4 process that the mayor had initiated in partnership with Andre Hines at the Hines Endowments, we were looking at how the city was going to grow and develop over the next, you know, 5, 10, 20 years. And what we started to understand was not just the physical place, but also that there's energy networks and systems underneath these neighborhoods that are
right.
helping to heat and cool. And in that conversation, we started a dialogue with the USW, actually, and Leo Girard, who was making this connection in terms of kind of manufacturing and the role of steel and pipe and tubing that helps go into these systems. And we forged a partnership with the Department of Energy. And at that partnership, we've created what's called a memorandum of understanding that now has philanthropy, the Department of Energy, university researchers, local utilities, and government thinking about how we can re-engineer the energy systems for the future of the city.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really why, you know, going back to the Pittsburgh way, that it's taken labor, government, university researchers, and the private sector, and neighborhoods now to neighborhood leaders really to kind of buy into that vision and now start to carry it forward.
Mm-hmm. And that's a really exciting project. It's really making some of the inherent inefficiencies in our energy system mm-hmm. basically get re-engineered mm-hmm. into something that will work better.
And one of the other things is when you can bring those diverse parties together and get them, you know, they don't have to march in lockstep, but if they're going the same direction, mm-hmm. that is a powerful force.
Extremely powerful. In the resilience space, we call it the resilience dividend. So mm-hmm. it's this idea that instead of just looking at a problem in kind of a linear fashion, that you're starting to connect all the dots and really integrate them together mm-hmm. to understand that, you know, every party can bring something to the table to help lift up the entire mm-hmm. community.
And the whole is better than the sum of the parts, because
right.
you have that amplification, as you were talking about before, of that effort. And what is your most exciting project? If we're going to have to tell people how to find out more about it, but the most exciting thing that you're doing right now, you can watch for.
I'm going to talk about something really boring, actually.
Yeah.
So I'm going to talk about parking garages.
Uh-huh.
So one of the things that's really interesting about that, and Marley actually knows this story.
You got to have some place to put your Corvette.
You got to have some place to put your Corvette someday, right? You know, it's again about this partnership of coming together where we were looking at an opportunity to advance the development around several of the parking garages that different city agencies bring together. And we brought together a network of the Urban Redevelopment Authority, some technology providers, the Green Building Alliance, which is one of our leading environmental NGOs. And we've been able to now change policy that enables new technology to be added, which created a significant economic investment that is resulting in major taxpayer savings in terms of the reduction of through energy savings. And that's enabling us to reinvest that into other places in terms of both our facilities and savings. And it's a good example because it's a simple example.
Yeah.
You know, is it exciting and sexy to talk about parking garages? Absolutely not. But it just shows you that working together, you can start to come together and solve some big challenges by finding common solutions.
You take care of the details, and then you've got more options.
That's right.
So how can we find out more about what you do? Do you have a website or something?
Yeah, we do. So you can learn more about the 1PGH plan at 1PGH, that's O-N-E-P-G-H, .pittsburghpa.gov, and I would be remiss if I said that's Pittsburgh with an H.
Yeah.
Everybody knows where that's at.
Well, Grant, we're going to have you back as this stuff unfolds. I think doing a resilience plan for a city as complicated as Pittsburgh has to be a challenge, and my hat's off to you for your effort and some of your great successes. So you'll have to come back and talk, and Marley, you're certainly welcome anytime. You're a budding star.
Patty.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Guys, it's always a pleasure. Marley, you can come back anytime. Anytime.
I'll be back.
Cool. Patty, very quickly, we got to talk next time you're in or soon. You've got a new program coming
online. The new American economy. We're going to be talking about emerging opportunities and challenges in energy, food and water, manufacturing and supply chain, transportation, and some on lifestyle when we have a fifth Wednesday.
Yeah,
every Wednesday from 1 to 2 from now on, we're going to be talking about the future of our economy.
And every once in a while, I get to talk about electric hot rods.
Oh, yeah.
And there's another story about that. 500 horsepower engine for a Chevy Volt. I'm telling you.
It's another thing. It's a great car.
Trying to get their production manager to be on our show at the end of May.
We're going to have some
fun
with this.
I'm down to the second from the top layer so far.
We're going to have some fun.
Hacking through the red tape.
Meantime, Marley, thank you for being here.
Yep,
you're awesome.
Welcome.
Don't pick on your kid sister, though.
I don't pick on her. She picks on me.
Okay. Meantime, I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Laborers Talk Radio.